Hey, wiretappers, I just want to warn you, the sound's a little bit messed up on this one. Cam and I did this, and we've been working real hard to get his sound over the phone perfect, and or at least closer to perfect, and sounding more like we're in the studio together, and it's hard to do, but we kind of messed up on this one. So it's going to start off with, it sounds like it's just me alone, and pretty soon you'll hear Cam talking, and the early part was really messed up, and the later parts are the sound's off a little bit, and I'm doing the best I can to get this one together. We had a lot of information, and I just didn't want to just redo it and take another couple of 3 hours to do all this again. And so I'll put this up as a bonus episode. I'll make sure you get an episode before and after that, like the Monday before and the Monday after, and put this one up in between. We're doing this whole month-long thing on mob meetings, as you know by now, because I've already had the two episodes on the Apalachin meeting. So I hope you'll forgive us for this, and we'll carry on and listen in.
You are listening to Gangland Wire, hosted by former Kansas City Police Intelligence Unit Detective Gary Jenkins.
Welcome, all you wiretappers out there. But I'm going to take you with me and back east to New York City, to the five families, if you will, that who think they're the king shit of all organized crime, even though we know that the outfit is as big by itself. At its height, it was as big as all five families in New York City. Now, I'll probably get a lot of flack for saying that, but they are. The outfit is huge, and it was when it was big, and it's still going. I mean, just like in New York City and Kansas City, we're just about done with mob stuff. And I think in Cleveland, they're done with mob stuff. And in Detroit, they're done with classic mob stuff. In South Florida, they're done. And in New Orleans, they're done. In California, they're done. It's all done except for Chicago and New York City area. I recently did a couple of, we had a movie on the Apalachin Convention in 1957, and I did a story on that, a two-parter, and that was in 1957. So naturally what comes along is what's the next big mob meeting after that? You know, we've had meetings, we go mob meetings, there's a long history of mob meetings. Remember, I think Al Capone, speaking of Chicago outfit, Al Capone kind of called the first mob meeting to get everybody together on this bootlegging thing when he saw how much money there was in it. So that's one of the first ones that I know of you know, kind of after they formed the National Crime Syndicate and people started working across state lines, when communications were available to talk from city to city, when it was easy to get from city to city, you know, cars and trucks and the railroad was connected everybody up closely, as well as the telephone. Of course, since then, there's been some other mob meetings. I know in 1946, right after the war, Lucky Luciano came back from Italy to Havana, asked for a big mob meeting to iron some things out, and kind of, I think he kind of wanted to pave his way to maybe get back into it a little bit, and certainly set up stuff in Cuba. And that's a whole nother story about what's going on, what's happened down in Cuba and in that area, which I need to get down in that. I had a fan just the other day ask me about doing something about South Florida and Traficante, and I did one on a guy named David Shanks, who was a police officer in, with Dade County, did an investigation on a guy named Jose Miguel Battle, who had a big policy operation, or Bolito, as well as he started into narcotics. And he was operating under Traficante, but he operated separately, but I think he must have been kicking back to Traficante all the time because he allowed him to operate. Coming on forward to the mob meetings after 46, and we had the 57 Apalachin Convention. That was one of the final straws that broke J. Edgar Hoover's back, to say, you know, hey, J. Edgar, there is a mafia out there. You know, what are all these guys doing from all these cities meeting together, and they're all in their individual cities are known as top hoodlums, as top, that's what he did. He created the top hoodlum program. We had a whole show on that with one of the agents who was part of the early top hoodlum program here in Kansas City. So he enlightened us to the history of J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI and their start into the fight against organized crime. And that really came on the heels and the exposure from that Apalachin meeting. So we come along, that's 1957. Well, in 1966, you know, I guess I should go back. You know, they discovered that Apalachin meeting because this New York State trooper kind of stumbled across it. Now, he was onto that guy. His name was Barbara, I think, Joseph Barbera, who lived in that kind of a rural estate. And he stumbled onto it because he saw all these funny cars showing up, all these limos. But he also stumbled onto it because he was in a motel. And he stepped back into an office when Barbera's son came in and wanted to reserve a whole bunch of rooms for unknown people. And that heightened his awareness. He also had already had a run-in with Barbera and realized, had done some investigation and found out this guy was connected to criminals in other parts of the Northeast from his history. He wasn't just some gentleman farmer that lived up in upstate New York that owned a little independently owned soda pop company in that area. So his antenna were up, and when that started happening, it wasn't just a fluke. He wasn't just driving by one day and it sees these black limos pulling in and men in shark skin suits and alligator shoes getting out and walking up into this house. He was onto that. So after the Apalachin Convention 1957, the next one we know about is in 1966. In a Queens restaurant called the La Stella. It's a really nice Italian restaurant in downtown Queens, close to the courthouse, actually. About every Northeastern mob boss, as well as a couple of mob bosses from down south, were there, which makes it really interesting mob meeting. Cam, do you remember who all was there?
We had Carlos Marcello out of New Orleans. He was the boss of the New Orleans family. Santo Trafficante was up from Tampa, Florida. He was the head of Tampa, Florida. Carlo Gambino, obviously head of the Gambino crime family in New York. Joseph Colombo, new head of the Colombo family in New York. Tommy Heavily and Mike Miranda, who were part of a trio who were heading the Genovese family out of New York, and I believe Mike Miranda, which is the host of the meeting, and Anthony Carolla, who was a lieutenant out of New Orleans, who was there with Marcello.
Right.
Were the major hitters.
Yeah, and Marcello's brother there, Joseph Marcello Jr., was there, and he brought a kind of interesting thing. He brought another guy named Frank Gagliano, who was a cousin to another guy. One last guy that was there was a kind of a soldier in the, Colombo family, Dominic Alunghi. Actually, in the Colombo family, Dominic Alunghi, who was Frank Gagliano's cousin. They were kind of like a family reunion there.
How did they find him up? How did the police come to find that they were in there?
That's always kind of right down my path there is how do the police do stuff, huh? People like to know the inside story on how the police do stuff, but it wasn't really just a stumble onto either. A lot of people want to think it's just a stumbled onto. It seems that at this point in time, Tommy Lucchese of the Lucchese family had inoperable brain cancer and wasn't supposed to live, and the New York Police Intelligence Unit kind of made an educated guess that, you know, they're going to have to be meeting and deciding who is going to take over the Lucchese family. Rumor was going around a guy named Carmine Tramonte was going to take it over, but he was in federal prison for a heroin charge at that point in time. So they were following around Mike Miranda, who was the consigliere and one of the kind of the main guy is helped run the Vito Genovese family while he was down in Atlanta for a heroin conviction himself. But this is how powerful Genovese was. He ran that family right out of Atlanta, which is how Joe Valachi ended up coming in, too, because he thought Genovese was going to have him killed. So that's a whole other story. We need to do a story about Valachi one of these days.
Valachi, yeah.
That would be a good one. Nobody ever talks about him. I'm over these mob websites. Nobody ever talks about Valachi. That amazing thing you see on these Facebook pages, especially if when you bring up somebody who has been a government witness, is you get this long string of rat, he's no good. And as one guy said, you know, it wasn't for these so-called rats, we wouldn't know anything about the mob. We wouldn't have anything to talk about.
Wait, I mean, what's worse, being a rat or being a murderer, heroin dealer who kills his associates? I mean,
really?
Like these guys would be noble things. So
or somebody that extorts money from businessmen and makes everything cost more, or steals your car.
Exactly. Like you were saying, with these cops, a lot of times it's not so much being in the right place at the right time as it is putting yourself
right. And that's what exactly right, Cam. Putting yourself in the right place, and then if you get lucky, then the right thing comes along. And so they're following these guys around, a couple of the top guys, and they probably had a tip or something, but they're following Miranda, and they saw him go in this restaurant. And this restaurant, the La Stella, it was a really well-known place for a lot of mob guys to eat, just to eat, not particularly to meet. They like those kinds of places where the owner probably is just an unfriendly guy to them. They probably have family members that know family members of the owner. We've got that in Kansas City. You've got that in every major city in the United States that has a mob presence. There'll be a restaurant that has family members that know family members of people in the outfit or the local mob. And they just, you know, they'll give them a room, and they're not going to go drop a dime immediately. Say, hey, you know, all these guys are meeting out here. They're just not going to say anything about it to them. They're just other customers, and they're not going to get involved in their business. So I'm sure that's what was going on with the La Stella in Queens.
Yeah.
So they're following this Miranda around, and they see him go in the restaurant. And I know how this works. You know, you follow some guy like that, and you see him go in a restaurant, so you maybe stick your head in and see where he's sitting or where he went. And, you know, if I'd have been doing this, I'd have stuck my head in. You wouldn't see him anywhere because he went downstairs into a basement room that was set up as a dining room. But you just kind of hang out and see if anybody else is going to show up. Just kill a little time and see what happens. And pretty soon, here comes Carlo Gambino, and that'll get their attention for sure. And with him, he has his consigliere, a guy named Joseph Gallo, who is not Crazy Joe Gallo. That's Joseph Gallo. I wanted to get in my mind why he wasn't Crazy Joe Gallo, which other than age, but he was an older guy. He's an old school mafioso from, you know, the 20s.
And Joe Gallo was the Colombo family.
Right. He had actually represented Florida boss Santo Traficante and New Orleans boss Carlos Marcello in other meetings, represented their interest. He had some kind of old connection to them. Many times you don't know, Cam, those old connections, how they go back. They did some business together back in the 30s or something, and then you go fast forward to the 60s, and they have this relationship. I mean, I have people myself that, you know, I can go pick up from back up home or some in my early career on the police department and get a hold of them. And, you know, we have a connection. So you've got the same thing here in the mob, I'm sure, because you want somebody you got a connection to and had some tie with in the past. You know, how we learned this is a guy named Ralph Salerno, who was kind of the New York City intelligence unit expert on the mafia and testified publicly in many different cases. He wrote one of the first books I ever read on the mob. Did you ever read Ralph Salerno's book?
Salerno, yeah.
He's testifying about this meeting later on. He said that these intelligence officers, one of them knew Santo Traficante by sight from some previous encounter he'd had or seen him in New York City. Because, you know, Traficante was in New York City in 1957 and checked out of the hotel the day after Albert Anastasia was killed. So it's not, how suspicious is that?
Checked out the same morning from the same hotel where Albert Anastasia was killed several hours later.
Right. I tell you, there was something there. Anastasia, I know he was trying to move and groove on his own and get bigger and probably
everybody's toes.
He was pushing Lansky to get money out of his casinos in Cuba is one of the reasons before that, which would make sense. Traficante's got really good connections down in Cuba.
Yeah.
So anyhow, they knew they were onto something. Now, as Salerno testifies, as any good policeman will do, when you see something like this, is what I would do. I'd see, two or three guys like this, especially when you get an out-of-town guy. You get on the phone and you call back to the office and say, hey, we got something here. I don't know what, but we got something. They get on the phone. They start sending other officers out to help you with the surveillance. They're going to get on the phone with the feds. In this case, they got on the phone with the Queens County prosecutor because he happened to have a grand jury going that was investigating organized crime at the time. And that guy said, let's pay attention to this. These guys probably have something to say to my grand jury, and we'll get them subpoenaed. So they get the surveillance set up, and they start seeing more and more people going in, and people that they know, and people that you just mentioned and we just talked about. All of a sudden, they're seeing all the heads of the five families except for Joe Bonanno from the Tom Lucchese family and Joe Bonanno family. Now, Lucchese, of course, they're supposedly talking about replacing him. I'm not sure why they wouldn't have somebody from his family there. That was the other one. And Joe Bonanno wasn't there. Purportedly, there was the Bananas War. There was a big split in the Bonanno family at the time, and it's the supposition that's why he wasn't there.
Bonanno had been banned from New York at that time for setting up the attempted hit on the other gunman, Bagliocco, and he was banned. His son was banned. He had set up Gaspar Di Gregorio in his place. At the Bonanno family, and they were divorced, so nothing from the Bonannos.
So this Queens County prosecutor, his name was Nat Hintel, and he said he wanted to identify all these men because they had this grand jury going, and like I said before, they could probably subpoena them, and they would have some evidence for this grand jury. A lot of this is just supposition. A lot of this is Nat Hintel. He just wants to mess with them a little bit, and let's see who they are.
He was an interim district attorney who had been nominated by Rockefeller, Governor Rockefeller, and he was running. He was a Republican in a strong Democratic area, so he was trying to run on something.
So what better than a big mob bust, right in your bailiwick, and where you could get a lot of headlines, and which they did, because it appears to me, I think I mentioned this before, from that news clip that's on YouTube, and I'll put a link up to on the show notes of these guys all going out. By the time they take them outside, there's about, I don't know, I'd say 10 reporters there, and flashbulbs going off all over the place, plus a video camera going, which at that point in time in 1966, they just didn't run out with their little camcorder. You had to bring a whole big operation out to set it up to get any kind of decent video. So they were set. They knew as the cops went in on this thing, I think as soon as they called that prosecutor, he turned around and dropped a dime to the media and got them all lined up.
Absolutely. When you watch that footage, and like you said, you're going to post it, it's so well staged where the cameras are up. It's not like somebody's sort of lugging that giant camera down the street trying to just catch somebody's earlobe as they get into the paddy wagon. It's just a perfect setup for all these guys being led down the steps. I mean,
It was a classic mob perp walk, too. They were handcuffed to each other, and they were trying to take their free hand, put their coats over their head, duck down, and all that. It's a classic. And you can see those reporters, clamoring around and yelling, and they got their notepads out trying to get – what do they say? You're going to say, well, why are you here, Mr. Gambino? What's he going to say? Well, we're here to – they're all ready to take down that quote. So the cops arrested these guys. I find this interesting. I think I need to explain some of this, how the cops worked. That's part of my deal, is how did the cops work? So they arrest them for
– these charges that they could just pick somebody up. I mean, they didn't seem that they were doing anything. So.
Right.
they were just sitting around. What was this charge that they could be charging these guys with?
Yeah, how do you walk in and find 8 or 10 men just sitting around eating and then arrest them? For what? Good question. Well, what they did, you know, in Kansas City at one time, we had this thing called known criminal arrest, check recent activities, and then they'd hold them overnight, make them stand in a show up, take a picture of them with a bunch of other guys that were just like that, and then kick them loose the next morning with no intention of charging them. Well, about this time, 66 or 67, that they quit doing that because it was, you know, they had no reason to arrest them other than they were a known criminal. But that's what they did. They arrested these men for consorting with known criminals. And in Kansas City, they would say, check recent activities. Because, you know, people, they often think that police can just randomly snatch somebody up off the street and force them to go in the station. But you really can't. If somebody says, no, what's the charge? No, I'm not going with you. Then the copper better come up with some articulable reason. That's a $25 word there. But some reason they can write down on why they're making you accompany them, why they're arresting you. And if they can't and they take you anyway, basically it's false arrest. And you got a pretty good case for a violation of civil rights. But a lot of people you deal with on the streets, mainly, they don't know that. So, you just like bluff them and just say, oh, you know, we need to talk to you about this crime here. You know, you don't want me to arrest you, do you? You want to come on downtown with me and let's just talk about this. And most of them will say, yeah, okay, I'll go along. Hardly anybody ever, back in my day, they never said no. They just went along. But it was a bluff. What we used to do is, and we get somebody, we'd say, we want to make them spend a night on the iron. That'll loosen them up a little bit. You got somebody that you even think is peripherally involved with some kind of a crime, and you'll accuse them of it, take them in, book them on that crime, and hold them overnight. And then the next morning, you don't have any charges to place against them. Why? They just release them. But sometimes you go down the next morning and talk to them a little bit and try to bluff them, say, well, we're going to take you across the street and charge you. And then they might actually maybe start giving you some information. There's all kinds of little tricks that the cops do. I don't think they do that at all anymore.
So these guys basically just charged with being around each other because they were all known
criminals. Yeah. Now, since you had the prosecutor. Yeah, really. Really. Now, you know, since you had the prosecutor on board with this, I see in the history of this that they made them each post a $100,000 bail and, of course, gave them a subpoena for the grand jury. That's crazy. That is crazy. But they had the head of every mob family. Oh, the one we didn't mention was Anello Della Croce was there. Yeah, he was an up-and-comer at the time in whatever family he took over, and all of a sudden I've lost it.
He was the underboss of the Gambino.
Okay, he was.
When Carlo died, it was either Nello Della Croce or Paul Castellano, and Della Croce was Gotti's mentor.
I see. So that's why Gotti was mad about Castellano taking over and beating his mentor out.
And he waited until Della Croce was dead.
Yeah.
And basically, as soon as Della Croce died, Castellano was killed.
Interesting. And then Gotti was able to take his rightful place, which if Della Croce had been the boss for a while, then Gotti would have been the underboss and would have gone ahead and been the boss after Della Croce.
Yeah, Gotti wouldn't have.
I tell you what, you got to know, you got to have a scorecard to keep track of the players sometimes in this operation, don't you? Ralph Salerno remembered that the total bail, and if you think of it, there was 13 of them, as $100,000 each, was $1.3 million. He said the court asked what collateral, if any, that the bail bondsman had, and the bail bondsman told the court, he said, well, I'm kind of out on a limb for this, but they promised me that they would pay or repay me. But somebody came down there with a legitimate promise to play $1.3 million for these guys. And of course, they're all going to show up. They're not going anywhere. That's a pretty safe deal. That'd been a good bond to post for some of that. If you're a bondsman, if you get 10% on that one, that'd be a good one. Although they're not going to ever pay you 10%.
Well, they own him anyway.
Yeah, they own him anyhow. He owed them. So, you know, supposedly they're topic, and I think it seemed like everything I read, most people agree that they were going to talk about replacing Tommy Lucchese. One guy, I think it was on the Gangsters Incorporated website, they posed the question, I have to agree, why were Florida and New Orleans bosses there to be talking about an internal decision of the five families in New York City?
I read somewhere, Marcello said something about if they had been there a day earlier, they would have really seen a lot of power. Well, I can't remember where I saw that remark, if it was in the site you sent me, but Marcello said something along the lines, if they had picked up a day earlier, they would have seen a lot more people. I think sort of implying that if this was, that there had been something a day earlier. And I think that if they were discussing Casey, it would have been at a bigger meeting. And I think that probably this, my feeling is this is a follow-up to a larger meeting. I think this is like dealing with a smaller issue that didn't require a larger meeting. I think that there was a bigger nationwide meeting that happened to be going on maybe the day before, and we're still in town.
Yeah,
there was a lot of stuff going on in 1966 in all the families.
Yeah.
The Bonanno War, Casey was sick. They just kicked Sam Giancana out in Chicago. Jimmy Hoffa, his appeals were almost done. His lawyer was Frank Regano, who also represented Carlos Marcello of New Orleans and Santo Traficante of Tampa. So they had the inside track on how his court was proceeding. Once he goes away, he's in charge of their bank, the Central States Pension Fund. So they definitely had to worry about that. So nationwide, there was a lot of business going on. I think it would have been a good time to have a big meeting with everybody. I can't remember where I read that quote by Marcello. It was something about if they had showed up a day earlier, they would have seen more.
Yeah, I think that was after he got back. I remember that it was after he got back down to New Orleans or something. But
FBI recording or something.
Yeah, Ralph Salerno, he broke down where they sat, and there's a picture of exactly where they sat. Now, I'm kind of a big one on body language and especially how people sit in meetings. I remember when I was when I first became a sergeant, I had a district. I had about six guys that worked for me, and I noticed that the sergeant always sat, is a rectangular table. The sergeant always sat at the back chair looking out at the head of the table, if you will, looking out, watching the door, kind of the gunfighter's chair. If you ever sit with a policeman in a restaurant, they always want to sit watching the door. And so that's like the most, and in body language and in business or whatever, the most important man in the room, I don't know if women do this, will always take that chair watching the door, and it'll become the head of the table, and it's a rectangular table. So then the people that sit closest to the head of the table will be the more important people, and the people down at the far end of the table will be the less important people. So there's a picture, and I'll have this in my website in the show notes. Mike Miranda, who was representing Vito Genovese and supposedly called this meeting, he was seated at the head. And it kind of tells you how important, I think, Genovese place was in the mob, that he can have his consigliere call this kind of a meeting and sit at the head of the table. And the people right up next to him are Marcello, Santos Traficante, Tommy Eboli, Joseph Colombo, and Carlo Gambino. So they were the more important people that were there by body language, shall we say. And the lesser people were on down at the further end of the table, and one of them was this Anthony Carolla, who we'll talk about in a minute, because he's the one who made a complaint about Marcello in New Orleans, and that supposedly is a reason why they were there, according to some sources. On down at that table were Carlos Marcello's brother, Joseph Marcello Jr., a former New Orleans resident named Dominic Longhi, and he happens to be Tommy Eboli's driver. And then his cousin, Frank Gagliani, is there, and he is currently from New Orleans, and he will go on to, his son is still involved with the mob today down in New Orleans. Anello Della Croce, who was Gambino's underboss, And then at the very foot of the table was a little-known soldier for Tommy Iboli named Anthony Carrillo. And Salerno surmises that this was the guy who probably did all the grunt work, made the arrangements, and was probably going to pay the bill when they were done, because he said, you know, he said the henchmen always pay the bill. The bosses never pay the bill. So I just think that's interesting that you know, no matter where you are, the boss sits at the head. The guys that want to be close to the boss will sit close to the head, and the guys that can't be close to the boss or don't want to be close to the boss will be on down at the end of the table.
That's interesting.
What they learned later on was that the most logical reason for this meeting here, as you said, it was probably a meeting after the meeting, and I've read that in other sources, was they had a dispute down south, and Anthony Carrillo had a dispute with Carlos Marcello. And I read two different things about why Traficante was there. One is that he and his operations were so closely tied to Marcello and the New Orleans family because of mutual interest and geography. And the other reason was that he was actually supporting this Anthony Carrillo in his dispute against Marcello. So, you know, we'll never know for sure. Now, who is Anthony Carrillo? I never heard of him before myself.
He was a cousin of Marcello, and he wanted a bit more power in the family. I think he was related to whoever, I can't remember who Marcello took over for, but I believe that Anthony Carrillo has been in the family for a while. He wanted a bit more power. He felt like he was growing up. He wanted a bit more attention than what Marcello was giving him.
I remember now, his father was a guy named Silvestro Carrillo, and he was the boss before Marcello, and he got deported, and probably before this kid was old enough to do anything, and he got deported, and Marcello took over, and Marcello was a really strong character. You get that guy in charge, Hell, somewhere out of this, I think when he got back to New Orleans after this, he hit an FBI agent. The guy is something else. You know, another interesting little tidbit I learned about him, he's actually from Tunisia.
Yeah.
He's not from Italy or Sicily. He's from Tunisia originally. He's Italian, of course. And then when he claimed he was from Guatemala at one time, and so they deported him to Guatemala and then found out he wasn't from Guatemala and he got to come back. Do you remember that?
just dropped him in the damn jungle. He made it back, too. No cash in his pocket. He made it back.
They can make a Survivor show out of him, huh? When there's Bear Grylls show or Naked shows or whatever.
That's true.
Let's do that. I think the government ought to start doing that. Let's just see who's the toughest mob guy. We'll go grab up some guy that's some current mob guy. I know a couple here in Kansas City. They're about 70 years old now, and they're kind of still style themselves as mobsters, and take them down into South America and drop them in the jungle with, I guess you could give them a knife, maybe, but no money, no shoes.
Marcello pulled it off.
He did. I'm impressed.
And of course, Marcello is who they say had something to do with the Kennedy assassination. Just for a reference for anybody who might know him, Marcello is the New Orleans boss who they say might have been tied into that whole thing. That's another whole show that we could get into.
Yeah,
just talking about the potential Kennedy.
Yeah, there's a bunch of stuff on that Kennedy assassination with Traficante and Marcello and all that. It's you can really get in the weeds on that one. But I, you know, ever since they released those Kennedy papers, recent and most recent document dump after the what was the name of that? They kept those papers locked away for all these years. I can't remember the name of it. But anyhow, that is a whole nother show. That's a couple of three shows there probably. So there was an FBI agent down in New Orleans, Howard Hughes, interesting name. Howard Hughes, he had an informant that claims that the actual meeting to decide this dispute actually happened the day before, and this was just kind of a breaking of the bread, shall we say, to kind of get everybody back together, a little sit down after the dispute was settled. And what they did, they ruled against this Corolla kid, and they approved Marcello's brother, Joe Jr., to be the heir apparent to the family if Marcello ever stopped down. And he will eventually become the underboss, but he never becomes the actual boss of the New Orleans family at all. And Corolla, he just kind of drifted on off. I couldn't find much more about him after that.
Yeah, I think a couple things. The New York families were doing some business in New Orleans, especially the Colombos. And I think that this was an opportunity for Marcello to come up and ask for some insight into his family, involve Traficante, and it just built a little bit of goodwill. I think that's correct. That this was just a sit down after the fact, just to sort of build a little bit more goodwill, and having Traficante there is just as a buffer. Same thing with having Gambino there. He's sort of the overseer of New York, so there you had him there as a sign of respect. And I think that it was definitely sit down after major issues been, because why would Gambino need to be there? Because Marcello was having troubles with one of his soldiers.
Yeah, that makes sense. Now, yeah, there's one thing I read that Colombo, he had business with Marcello and had for a while. And one thing that said they had a big investment in an automatic shoeshine business. And there's one person that claimed that he was actually that Colombo was siding with this Corolla, but that didn't make sense because he had a whole bunch of money invested with Marcello, unless he was trying to ace Marcello out and not take over that business. You never know with these guys, as we discussed earlier.
So a little dissension in the ranks, you know, things split up and you swoop in to take the spoils.
Yeah. Now I do understand why Marcello was smart in getting this settled up in New York. And like in Nick Savella in Kansas City, when you got these big ducks and you're not, you know, the whole New Orleans family, which in New Orleans is kind of a lucrative market, you know, they had a good big port and lots of gambling, lots of vice activities down there. Frank Costello had already been involved with slot machines down there back in the 30s and 40s and setting up carpet joints and all that. It's a pretty lucrative market down there in New Orleans in particular, plus the port down there. There's a ton of money to be made around a port, as they know in New York City. So they're smart, you know, like Nick always brought Chicago in on any major decisions, and he kicked up to him on any action, even when he didn't have to. If it was action outside of Kansas City, because like he was getting skim out of the Tropicana, and Chicago didn't help any in him getting that stream of skim, but he kicked up to him. And I got a feeling that Marcello and Traficante both were pretty canny, and they knew they had mutual interest, and they knew that they always wanted to get along with these guys in New York because they were the big ducks. So, you know, if you got a dispute, let's just go with them and help, get them to help us settle and make them part of it. And that way, when it's settled, it's settled. Corolla wouldn't dare come back and do anything if they had this kind of a sit-down in New York and they ruled against him.
I think that's a good point. You see a lot of that with the smaller families. Even in Philadelphia, you see Angelo Bruno being friendly with Gambino and a lot of the other families. The second tier, the smaller groups, Sam DiCavalcanti in Jersey was tight with Lucchese's. I want to say second tier, but they're outside of Chicago. New York definitely showed that they're tighter with the larger groups. Cleveland was tight with the Genoveses and with Chicago. They definitely reached out to them whenever there was anything going on. So, the only exception to see to that is Raymond Patriarca, who kind of did his own thing and stood up against the Genoveses in his own way, but it was kind of a unique piece. He didn't really kowtow to many people.
Yeah. What about Bufalino? How did he relate to New York City and the five families?
Bufalino was Western Pennsylvania.
Yeah, Western Pennsylvania. So he's reasonably close, but you don't really ever hear him being figured in with any of this five family stuff.
That's sort of he was tight with John LaRocca, and John LaRocca was Pittsburgh.
Oh, okay. So it's Pittsburgh.
Yeah, so
okay.
That sort of whole area with Cleveland and Bufalino in western Pennsylvania, La Roca in Pittsburgh, and just that whole sort of area there with the mines and some racing and different things. Bufalino, he was tight with with Cleveland too, wasn't he? He worked a lot with Cleveland. I guess it was a lot of back and forth.
Yeah, I think along the Lake Erie up there, and there's money to be made along there, and the kind of the Rust Belt and a lot of vice activities with all the unions.
Yeah, so he put a little bit into New York also. I guess once Stefano Magadino sort of lost, was that family sort of stepped aside. Bufalino probably oversaw some going on up there.
So it's interesting. Geography kind of is part of it, and how it works when you're close. What I always found crazy about that is the little bit mob we have in St. Louis never really had anything to do with Kansas City. They would have more to do with Detroit. Their roots came out of Detroit. The whole time I was working it, Giordano, yeah, he was a boss there for a long time, but there was no interaction between Kansas City and St. Louis, but there was a lot between Detroit and St. Louis, so go figure. But you gotta, like I said, you gotta have a scorecard to keep track of the players. Now, you know, the New Orleans mob family is basically no more. I thought, I'm gonna take a look at this. I haven't heard anything about them. It's basically really no more. It's all they talk about, these different drug gangs and that kind of thing going on down there. But I did find, and they talk about the Colombo family and New Orleans. In 1991, there was a Gambino capo named Joseph Carozzo. They called him Jojo. And his partner was another Gambino guy, Johnny Gianmarco. Oh, God, this is a tough one. Johnny Gamarano. He brought a friend down from New York, Johnny Gamarano. They set up a scheme in New Orleans and partnership with Joseph Gagliano, who was a son of Frank Gagliano, who was the New Orleans mob guy that was up there with Marcello at the 1966 meeting. They figured out a way to skim money from the newly legalized video poker industry in Louisiana. I guess all over Louisiana, they've got video poker and bars and stuff.
And the mob owns all of it. Here it's all over Illinois. You see video poker all over. It was just in Stager today. Mob owns all that. Recently, there was a meeting of the heads of the Illinois State Gaming Commission. They met in Las Vegas, and they all got together with state officials, and they all ate at a big Italian restaurant. The owners of the video poker machine corporations and the state gaming officials got together in Las Vegas and ate at a big Italian restaurant.
They're all in bed together, aren't they? Well, Interesting. That's one reason I used to do work for the State Gaming Commission here when I first started practicing law as a kind of an arbitrator for them. They needed some legal expertise and settle disputes between when a casino came afoul of the gaming rules or an casino employee came afoul, they could appeal, and I would hear their appeal as almost like a judge. And you know, after a couple of years, I didn't like it. Those casino people and the people that ran those casinos, they were a little bit slimy for me. And I don't know, I just, and then the state changed and all of a sudden they had a different administration that wasn't the one that appointed me. And I could see they were working real hard to try to use this to denigrate the other side. The attorney general was the other side at the time, and the government and the governor and then became a different party. And that's when I just got out. Like, I'm not dealing with this well.
Can you imagine yourself as a young officer? You're following Tuffy DeLuna, and you follow up the local motel and checking out 15 rooms, and you follow he shows up at a nice restaurant, so you're waiting outside, and all of a sudden, Xavella pulls up and waits in the parking lot, and then Cork Xavella pulls up, Willie Camisano pulls up, then it looks like Jimmy Iuppa pulls up, and they meet in the parking lot, go in, and then a car drops off, and I don't know who else you recognize from around the country.
Yeah.
What do you, Gary, as a young officer, you mean, these like I said, you know, you got Camisano and then DeLuna and the both of the Sabellas, and then all of a sudden Ayumba from Chicago shows up and a couple other faces that you don't recognize, but you know they're out of town, and you can tell by the way Cork and Nick greet them that they have some importance. They all go to sit down in this restaurant. How do you see?
You know, the first thing you do is just like Ralph Salerno said, you know, this was a bright young officer. As soon as he saw Trapicante there, he called the office. He called his boss. So, you know, the first thing you do, if you're out watching this, as soon as you see that guy in from out of town and you didn't know he was going to be in town, nobody knew it, you call the office and they call over at the FBI, what we called the One Squad at the time, and called Bill Owsley was a supervisor, and I think Mike Shanahan was after that. So immediately, you know, your boss is going to call the One Squad supervisor, and then they're going to send out a couple of guys, and they're going to be asking their informants and jumping on their phone saying what's going on if they didn't know about it. And they'll send a couple of people down, maybe or maybe not. And then we'll get several more people down, and we'll just start writing down license numbers. Now, we probably will go inside and at least sit down at the bar, sit down and eat and see what we can see on the inside. Sometimes we'll try to get a female officer that we don't have one working in a unit. You'll try to find somebody that you know, and you can go in like a date and kill some time in there. And that was kind of our usual kind of a ruse on a deal like that. Although, you know, they're already in there. And if they're in a private room that you can't really tell, you just try to walk in there and just start stumbling around and see if you can't get down to that where that room is, at least get a glance inside. And then when it's over, the main thing is to have enough people there, because you're not going to be able to take everybody in just because you see them together anymore by this point in time. You just can't do it. Those days were gone by then. That's a lot of power to grant some high school educated policeman power just to pick somebody up for any reason and take them in and hold them overnight. And although it was kind of effective, although we did kind of subvert it for a while, but you can't quite push it that far. So, you know, then you just take the major players and see what they do afterwards. I'll tell you a couple of stories about like local meetings trying to bug them. We knew these were coming, and in one, the meeting was going to be in the study. They knew that. So they go, the Bureau gets in the house, we get the hidden microphones all placed in the study, and they get there, and these guys have gotten hit by now. They had the meeting in the bedroom. And at that point in time, that was a big no-no to ever put microphones in a bedroom or in a bathroom. That was the Department of Justice. You'd have to have more specific probable cause. You'd have to really have some solid reasons to know that this meeting that you needed to bug was going to be in a bedroom. And now absolutely never in a bathroom, hardly.
That's, you know, Frank L. Reese, that's his father used to take him right to the bathroom and turn on the sink when he wanted to say something.
Yeah, that would be the smartest place to go, especially for guys like that, there's no telling why they've got a wiretap or a bug microphone going. They just got one going all the time practically. And then we had another one to Bill Owsley, my FBI agent friend. Alan Dorfman, I think, came down for this. Alan Dorfman came down from Chicago and maybe Lombardo, somebody else came down, and this is not reported anywhere because they didn't really need to say how they learned this information, and they learned some stuff that they didn't, that they knew Kansas City was going to be doing something with the Teamsters Pension Fund, and it was important because they couldn't really get everything, but they were going to meet in a hotel room, and they didn't know it till the last minute. Bureau runs up there, they get an adjoining room, and Bill gets up against the wall with a glass. You've heard of that? And he said it worked. He could hear a lot. Yeah. So it seems like, you know, we had the one big meeting, but we knew it was coming. We had it all bugged up for the skim investigation out of Las Vegas, and we had Joe Augusto, who was their guy in Las Vegas, and another guy named Carl Thomas came back and met with Nick Sabella and Carl DeLuna and Carl Sabella, and they talked about skimming all day long. And just before those guys got there, they talked about a mob hit that they were planning, And the guy that they were talking about doing, I got the transcript. It's really great information, but I can't get the audio because they never went through with it, and there was never a charge filed, and I can't get audio from the archives unless it was an exhibit in court. It was displayed in court. So but I do have the transcript. Like Willie Camasano, they said, well, Willie Camasano says, you know, if you're going to take the tree down, you need to chop off some branches first. And what they were talking about is killing off some of the other guys before they got to the tree. And then Nick Savella says, well, you know, that guy lives out in the country. He said, who we got? You know, they can't go out in the country and run around. They said, oh, no, Willie says he can hit him from, you know, like a mile off with a high-powered rifle. And Nick says, we don't have anybody that's that good a shot. Oh, it's a classic. I've thought about getting a couple of actors to reenact that thing. It would be good.
Oh, man, that would be. That's a good idea. Take some of those old recordings. Just have a couple people just read them.
Yeah.
Dramatic interpretations.
Yeah, really. It would be interesting. All right, so I think we've come to the end of the La Estrella meeting, and it will go nicely with our Apalachin meeting. I don't know if we haven't stumbled across a meeting, big meeting like this for a long time. I think they finally got gun-shy after a while.
there was one with Shin Gigante and Bobby and Picamuso, and they had all their underbosses with them. Of course, Carmine Versco was in prison, and Joe Messino, they weren't talking to Bananos yet, but that's the last one I know of Enzo Lucchese, Genovese, and Gambino all sat down together, and that was in the 90s sometime when Gotti was still in power, so maybe the late 80s.
Yeah, interesting.
That was the last thing I've heard of.
Huh. All right, well, folks, this has been great, Cam. I'm really glad that you're helping me with this. It makes my job easier and makes a richer experience, I think, for our listeners out there to get a little more information out and a different view of it. You know, sometimes I have a kind of a one-sided police view of everything. So, folks, if you have a friend or relative who has a problem with drugs or alcohol, make your first call to First Call. Call 816-361-5900 or go to their website, www.firstcallskc.org. And if you want to support this podcast, go to your Venmo app and hit me up for a buck or two. Buy me a cup of coffee. It's Gangland Wire, all one word. Mark Ryan, I really appreciate what you've been doing on Venmo. Let's get some more people out there. I'll give you your protection just like Mark Ryan's got. Nobody's going to mess with him, or they got to mess with me now. That's how it works, right, Cam?
That's right.
When you're in my crime family, you paid your dues, you know. So if you want to support the podcast in other ways, you can go to my website, www.ganglandwire.com. And some fan was kind of making fun of me for saying www.ganglandwire.com, but I think it was in good fun. He said he loved hearing me say that in my Northwest Missouri nasal twang. I need to get Frank Culotte or somebody to say some of this stuff for me. They got those cool kind of gangster accents. Andrew DiNonato or Frank Calabrese Jr. But go to the website, and in the shop page, you can hit the donate button and use PayPal or use your credit card. You can buy my movie, Gangland Wire, buy my book, Leaving Vegas, How FBI Wiretaps Ended Mob Domination of Las Vegas Casinos. And I suggest you can buy it off my website, and I make a little more money that way. But go get the Kindle version, because it's linked to about 20 of the wiretaps that and hidden microphones that we gathered information from during the investigation. So you can be reading the book and reading an explanation of what they're talking about, and then actually hear the guys saying the words themselves. So that's why I did that. I thought it would be a really unique thing. I don't know if any other book out there like that.
I've never seen
it. Yeah, I've got one book here. I got that George Anastasia did that uses a whole bunch of wiretaps information, the transcripts out of them, but you can't hear the guys that said it. So I think it's unique. I have my Kansas City Mob Tour app on the Apple Store. So I think that's all I got for this evening, folks. I appreciate y'all tuning in. And Cam, thank you a lot. We'll be in touch.
All
Good night.
Yes, sir.
Good night, wiretappers.
Music provided by our good friend and super fan from Portland, Oregon, Casey McBride. Thanks, Casey.
All right, so that I'll have to do a little editing on this. I think I can plug this back together.
You gotta set up that Patreon.
Yeah, I know. I need to do that. I just keep.
My wife's been putting on some podcasts, and they all talk about that they all use that Patreon.
Yeah, I know. I even have an account. And start and I need to do that, I guess. I don't know. Cam, I get into doing these projects where I'm actually working, and I forget about the other, and then it's the end of the day, and it's like I'm sick of looking at this computer or writing or whatever, and so I don't get around to doing it. But it's a real good way to do these kinds of things. Hell, some of those podcasts that I looked them up once that one is not one for me or you. It's called Sword and Scale. I don't really like the guy that does, but that guy had about $10,000 a month coming in donations. Because when you've got 200,000 or 300,000 people listening to your podcast, it's pretty easy to do. It's kind of a numbers game.
I think there's a lot more. Every time a new mob movie comes out, people are going to start Googling. I mean, that's how I discovered you,
Yeah. And there's more and more coming out. There's a Hoffa movie still to come out. There's the Appalachian movie's coming out. I just saw something about a couple more. So as they keep doing that.
So damn script about, how the outfit got started after Capone.
Yeah.
I sent it to an agent. He looked at it. He said, it needs a little bit of work. I need to send it back.
Yeah. Well, I think you're getting into uncharted territory there with the outfit, and there's great stories up there, and not much has been done. Crime Story is the only one that really has done much about Chicago, and they moved out to Las Vegas pretty quick in Crime Story as far as that kind of a narrative story.
Yeah.
So Chicago is a rich ground for that. I mean, you got Chicago Fire, Chicago Police. There's several shows about Chicago that have been successful. So I think you're onto something. You just have to hope hope you can just hit at the right place at the right time. that's what it comes down to.
I keep an eye on things. Did you see that interview with that guy, Jeremy Tillinghast?
What was
it? He did 30 years. He was with the. He did a lot. He was a soldier for the Patriarchas. He was out of Rhode Island. He was interviewed. He just had a book came out in November last year. He did a 30-year stint for murder. He was part of that. There was a big. Armed robbery up there. But they got $3 million or something.
Yeah.
Said to rob his own man when he was in prison.
Huh? You sent me a link on that.
The bonded vault heist. That was a big one.
Oh yeah, I remember that.
This guy was involved in that, and he just came out with a book. I think I emailed it to you today.
Oh okay, I just hadn't seen it.
Doing little shows and stuff. The author he wrote it with was a cop.
Yeah.
And was a cop. His father had arrested the guy. The guy's a cop who's got a couple
cool.
calls out. Jerry Tillinghast. But yeah, check your email.
Yeah, I will. I will. I'll check on that.
He was on this podcast, Crime Town, not too long ago, where they were doing.
Oh yeah. Oh that guy. Yeah, that was. He was a good one. Yeah. That was a good one. That was interesting because they talked to him. They talked to. I guess it was the father of this guy. They talked to one of the cops that chased him around. Yeah, that would be great. Finding that combination.
He just came out with a book though in November.
Yeah.
And he's trying to promote it and stuff. He's a plain spoken guy. He's talking in the interview talking about, I never knew that Bulger fucked that fucking asshole.
Yeah.
Just, street guy.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I'm a.
He never talked or anything. Yeah, but watch that interview.
I'm going after that one. Yeah.
But Shit, I mean, you've gotten some hitters on here before. I mean, he and there's a couple guys, Patrick Nee, who was another Irish crime guy out of Boston. He does a couple of his shows and stuff. He's got a book out too.
Yeah, I'll have to look that up. You know, I'm not seeing that. I'm not seeing an email from you here.
Let me see what I did here.
I could probably find it, but
I thought I. Yeah, here. Let me check with the.
Oh yeah, I see a Wikipedia on bonded vault heist. Mobster leaves prison from the. I haven't seen anything about his book yet. The big league prospect became a.
I just sent you the YouTube interview.
Okay.
A local interview he does with somebody up in Rhode Island. I don't think it's written much.
Okay.
But this bonded vault movie is coming. They optioned for a movie. A book just came out about bonded vault heist. Now he said, "Well, I was found innocent. I was found not guilty.
Yeah.
I'm all about it, but I was found not guilty. So that's I didn't do it."
Okay.
That's what he said.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah, I'll see if I can't find him. That would be a good one.
He says it got inside of his mouth, but he's real plain spoken guy. Well, watch that interview. You'll like
it. I will. Okay. Yeah, he was. I listened to that one. I liked that one. I thought, oh boy, I got competition. But that Crime Town, they don't really do all that much.
No, they just did that one that I saw.
And then they got into the mayor of Providence. That's a kind of a crazy story. They focused more on that mayor of Providence, Rhode Island, for the while.
Buddy
they didn't, yeah, Buddy Cianci.
Yeah, they were just showing that. Was.
Yeah, okay, yeah, that's what it was, crime, that's why it was called Crime Town, but they didn't do any more mob stuff. Of course, they made money off that because they had that big company behind them, and so they may be developing another story along those lines, doing a story, you know, if you can get kind of across the board thing, why, I can see where you might want to do that.
Those guys are big documentary filmmakers.
Yeah, yeah. All right, it's hard to compete with those people who've already made $1 billion doing this stuff and have all the technical stuff and can pay people to go do all the little stuff that you don't want to do. Oh well, we'll keep doing what we're doing. We got a lot of people that like it, so we'll just keep this up.
Anything I can do to help you
out. All right.
What you want to do? I'll reach out. I'll try and shoot a message off that Matthew Losey, the guy who wrote that voice in Chicago Heights.
Okay. All right. Yeah. Do that. We'll get him on here.
You know, I know you've done Chicago for a while, but you know, I've seen everyone on LinkedIn before.
Okay. All right. All right. I better go do something now. See if I can't put this thing together.
Hey,
all right, Cam. Talk to you later.
Be in touch.
Okay. Bye.